If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. Professor Saul Dubow describes the Boer War as the last great conflict of the Victorian era, one that also had enormous ramifications for the people of Britain and Southern Africa. Today, we'll be talking to Saul, who's Smuts Professor of Commonwealth History at the University of Cambridge, about what drove the war, what it was like for women and children caught up in the crossfire, and how the conflict impacted on Britain's feelings about the merits of the imperial project. As always, with our Everything You Wanted to Know episodes, the questions are drawn from a mixture of popular internet search queries and ones that you've submitted on our various social media platforms. Putting the questions to Saul was our production editor, Spencer Mizzen.
So we're here to talk about the Boer War. Now, I wonder if we could start with a question from D Brand, which was submitted on Instagram. And that is, what was the Boer War and who was involved? Now, I know this is quite a basic question, but it'd be great if you could give us, a five-minute overview of the conflict, laying out the chief milestones.
So the Boer War broke out in 1899 and concluded with the Treaty of Vereeniging in 1902. It was a war which was long in the making. In fact, many people distinguished between the First Boer War, the 1881 war, where the Transvaal regained its independence from the British, and called that the First Boer War. And indeed, there was for at least 25 years in South Africa a constant attempt by the British to impose forms of confederation on a region which was extremely diverse, two British colonies, two Boer republics, a number of African polities and kingdoms who were still functioning. The Boer wanted to, the British wanted to tighten this all up, neaten this all up, in their interest to gain overall control. And then you have diamonds discovered in the area around Kimberley in 1867, and gold in Johannesburg in 1886. And that means that this very confused late 19th century battle for geostrategic control is given a new sharpness through this mineral wealth. And increasingly, the British are wanting to gain control. They do manage to get hold of the diamond mines through a kind of legal mechanisms, which is then absorbed into the Cape. But the tough nut to crack is the Transvaal under the presidency of Paul Kruger. And by the last years of the 19th century, the Transvaal gold mines are producing, you know, more gold than anywhere else in the world. And the British, partly for their political reasons of wanting to finally impose their system of overall control through form of confederation, but also because the wealth of the gold mines is now so important. Johannesburg is an international destination for investment. The City of London is very involved in the process of gaining control of gold, and so it has much greater significance. Yeah. And in 1897, Lord Milner, who's one of the kind of British proconsuls, is sent out to the Cape as High Commissioner to finally sort the problem out. And he ramps up the pressure on Kruger all the way through. For example, he complains that British Eightlanders, outlanders, that is to say British-speaking workers on the mines, are not given franchise rights by Kruger. They have to serve 5 years. He complains about the dynamite monopoly. He regards Kruger as a kind of flat-earther, Dutch Puritan who's ill-suited to running a modern economy. And the pressure is ramped up more and more in 1895-1896. Cecil Rhodes, the mining magnate and then the Prime Minister of the Cape, sends in his auxiliary Jameson, and they attempt to raid the Transvaal and promote effectively a putsch with the help of the Eightlanders in Johannesburg, and that that completely fails.
Yeah.
That completely fails, and Kruger rounds up the Jameson raiders and puts them in jail. But from that moment of the Jameson raid, 1896, there is really no pause in the ramping up of political pressure as Milner becomes ever more determined to resolve this either through war or through negotiations. But negotiations are not really on the cards, because what Kruger says is, you know, you don't want, you want my country. And eventually in 1899, with the Boers realizing that the British mean to wage war, launch a preemptive attack and encircle a number of key towns and cities in siege warfare. And those are fairly protracted: Ladysmith, Mafeking, and so on, Kimberley. But eventually, those by 1900, and particularly the relief of Mafeking and Ladysmith, these are big moments in the Boer War. And the British under General Roberts enter Bloemfontein and Pretoria, the capitals of the two Boer republics. And most people think that this is the end of the war.
Yeah.
But the Boers, the bitter enders, as they're called, decide that they're not prepared to accept defeat. And so effectively this army of men who have always been fighting in commandos, in sort of civil commandos, leave for the veldt and begin a long and protracted guerrilla war. And the British realize then that they need new tactics. So they bring in a new general, Kitchener, of World War I fame, and he inaugurates a pretty devastating strategy, which involves setting up blockhouses all along the main arteries, the railways, and so forth, and then setting up concentration camps in order to, where he drives Boer women and children into these concentration camps. And this is an attempt to starve the Boer fighters so they can't go back to their farms to eat and to recover. And this is a vicious and a new kind of warfare, total warfare, if you like, which goes on until 1902, the Treaty of Vereeniging, when the British and the Boers finally get together and sign a peace agreement.
Now, not everyone agrees that Boer War is the best terminology, the best way to describe this conflict, do they?
Afrikaners used to call it the Britse Oorlog, the war against the British. And round about the centenary of the Boer War, it became, and still is, at least in academic parlance, much more common to refer to it as the South African War.
Yeah.
And the reason for that is twofold. Firstly, when the Boer War occurred, that's the 1899 to 1902 war, there was a sort of gentleman's agreement that this was a white man's war.
Yeah.
And that was partly because of the fear of, giving Africans guns. In fact, of course, Africans were fought and participated in various capacities on both sides of the war and died in the concentration camps. So the South African war reflects the idea that this was not just a white man's war, this was a pan-South Sure. African war. And it also reflects the fact that, in a way, it was a civil war. It was a war for South Africa. There was no South Africa that existed as a nation state until 1910. And that happened very directly as a result of the war. So many people prefer, academics certainly, and in teaching, prefer to call it the South African War as more accurate. But somehow the term Boer War has continued to stick.
Now, my next question comes from MHFQ, also on Instagram. And that question is, what role did armaments play in the conflict? But I want to broaden this out a bit, if I could, to ask me, why did it take, the most formidable imperial powers in the world so long to bring its advantages in terms of men and materiel, including armaments, to bear against the Boers? I mean, could the British be accused of complacency?
Well, the British had been used to winning and fighting and mostly winning small colonial conflicts, small wars. And they did, I think, believe that they'd be able to knock the Boers over very easily, just as in the First Boer War, Colley thought that he could, he thought the Boers were not really capable of fighting. So they certainly underestimated the Boers. The Boers were people who lived on farms. They were used to horses. They knew the landscape, the topography. And they also were able to source extremely good guns, German Mauser guns, because they were obviously people who shot for the hunt and so forth. So they were extremely skilled and mobile fighters. Kruger also was able to secure quite significant field artillery. So although the British forces together, that's the British, the Dominion forces, Canadians, Australians, and also colonial British forces numbered probably about 500,000 all in all, vastly outnumbering the Boers, they certainly underestimated the commitment of the Boers to defend their independence and also their proficiency on open fields of battle.
How effective was the Boers' tactic of what we term guerrilla warfare? I mean, was this something that the British were used to combating?
Well, this wasn't something that the British were used to. The Boers, in a way, made an error, at least it seems so in hindsight, by besieging the British. Because eventually the British were able to use their superior numbers and artillery power to break those sieges. But the guerrilla war was something new. And the Boers were mobile, they were skilled, they had these very effective guns, and which in many ways outperformed the Lee Metfords and Lee Enfields that the British had. But we should also remember that most of the people who died in the war, certainly most of the Boers, died from disease. And so there were a lot of civilians who died, and a lot of the casualties were casualties from not so much direct military engagements, but from the consequences of this total war.
I mean, that does kind of lead me on to my next question. I mean, what was life like for Boer women and children caught in the crossfire of this conflict?
Women and children suffered enormously. If you go to the Museum of the Boer War in Bloemfontein and you look at the exhibits, you realize very quickly that this really was became a war perpetrated on women and children. In the guerrilla phase of the war, women, Boer women and children, and also blacks who were servants and allies of the Boers were moved into concentration camps. And as many as 30,000 Boer women and children died in these concentration camps. Of course, they were not intentionally killed. They died from diseases of typhoid and as a result of lack of hygiene and also from starvation. So although they were not directly caught up in the crossfire, they suffered because they saw their farms, their homesteads burnt to the ground. They were moved to these concentration camps and thousands died.
Now, you just mentioned the concentration camps there, and that's a question submitted by Antique Steel on Instagram. That question is, how accurate is the statement that the British used concentration camps? Now, you obviously clearly think that they did. I mean, this is a hugely controversial aspect of the conflict, isn't it? I mean, what do you say to those politicians and historians who've argued that the camps were set up for the Boers' own protection, or indeed that their mortality rates were no worse than Glasgow at the time?
They were moved into concentration camps, and they were concentration camps because they were called concentration camps in order to starve the Boer fighters and to prevent them from going home to replenish their stocks and so forth. These were not necessarily the first concentration camps in the world. Some people argue that those were first used in Cuba. They were, of course, also used by the Germans in Namibia. And the important thing is, of course, they were not intended as extermination camps. They were concentration camps. They were often surrounded by barbed wire. They were under very close supervision. And as I said, something like 28,000 to 30,000 Boer women and children died in these camps. And we now know that around 20,000 black supporters and auxiliaries of the Boers died themselves in separate camps, racially segregated camps. So there's no doubt that they existed. There's no doubt that many more Boers died in concentration camps than died in the field of battle. And we actually know a great deal about the concentration camps and the horrors of the concentration camps from a very interesting British pacifist called Emily Hobhouse. Emily Hobhouse, who had links to the Quakers, went out to South Africa to investigate the camps, to investigate the appalling conditions. And she reported this. And one of the people she reported to was the Liberal leader, Campbell Bannerman, who later went on to refer to the Boer War as methods of barbarism. So there's no question that these concentration camps existed, that they were brutal, and that they, frankly, played a very significant role in the end in defeating the Boers.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
And they are very much taken by the fact that the Boers outfight the British, and that many of the recruits, the British recruits, coming from cities like London, are ill-nourished. There is a great fear that of eugenic deterioration in the British working classes.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Now, Mr. DeWeave on Instagram wants to know, how was the conflict viewed by the British public at the time? Was it a popular war?
Well, that's a very good question. We should remember that the Boer War took place. It was the kind of culmination of the jingoism in Britain that really came to light in the Afghan War of the 1870s. So there was a tremendous amount of patriotism, tremendous amount of enthusiasm, and a great deal of arrogance and complacency. When the Boer War failed to finish in a matter of weeks, and when the British were besieged in places like Ladysmith and Mafeking, this was given enormous coverage in the press. We should remember, too, that there were many British journalists who were reporting. Churchill, of course, was one of them. Edgar Wallace was another. Via Stent, G.W. Stevens, Daily Mail, and so forth. So this was covered very, very extensively in the British popular press. And the relief of Mafeking, which was under the command of Baden-Powell of the Scouts, was treated with enormous excitement. The word to mafic, to engage in sort of rowdy celebrations, comes from the relief of Mafeking. So there was a great deal of enthusiasm for the war, popular enthusiasm. But at the same time, I think it's important to note that the war really split the British public. It split the Liberal Party to a great extent. There were various, some were anti-imperialists, some were anti-imperialist, if imperialism meant exploitation and doing and supporting the presumed objectives of capitalists, but were not anti-imperialist if this meant extending civilization. So, you know, it was a kind of early example of a humanitarian war of intervention. But others were deeply involved and excited by the war, by the accounts of derring do and battles, and people like Churchill, who escaped from Boer as a Boer prisoner of war, and then re-entered the field, was present at Steenkamp and so forth. All this added to a kind of tremendous popular excitement about the war. The war was spectacle, and of course, it was also widely photographed, and there were movies as well. So this was an extremely well-covered popular war, in both senses of the word popular.
Yeah. Now, let's turn to the Battle of Spionkop, which is possibly one of the best-known incidents from the war. And Matt's LFC on Instagram was wondering if you just give us a bit of background to that and explain what happened.
Spionkop took place over about 24 hours, maybe a little more, in January 1900. Spionkop means Spy Hill, and it was situated on the route to Ladysmith. So the relief of Ladysmith was really the major objective. And there were two, it was a double-headed mountain or kopje, and the British first of all managed to get onto the lower slopes. They thought they'd got to the top, but when the fog lifted the next morning, they saw they were in fact not there. The British had the Boers rather had very accurate artillery, and also they had the use of their Mausers, their German-made Mausers, which were very effective, not least because they were smokeless guns. Eventually, the Boers managed to recover and to gain a sort of frontal assault during the day, which was unusual, to displace the British. In fact, the British prevailed, but such was the confusion and the deaths. There were several hundred who died on both sides, and the British actually withdrew because they felt they didn't have the support. So it is a Boer victory. It's not the most important battle by any means, but I think one of the reasons we know a great deal about Spionkop is the presence of Winston Churchill, who, after his escape from Boer incarceration, but also the presence of General Louis Botha, who went on to become the first Prime Minister of South Africa. And another interesting person who was there was Mohandas Gandhi. He was part of an Indian ambulance corps, a stretcher bearer. So at least three very prominent political figures all were in and around Spionkop. And I think that's one of the reasons why it remains so much part of historical memory.
Now, here's a question from Jumpin' Jacks on social media. And he was saying, can you tell us a bit more about the Boers' history? How long had they been in Southern Africa?
Well, that's a good question. South Africa was first colonized in the mid-17th century, 1652, by the Dutch, East India Company. It was used just as a refreshment station on the way to their possessions, their colonial possessions, spice trade in the East Indies. And over the course of the 17th and 18th century, the settlement at the Cape expanded, and it expanded through people calling themselves Boers, that is, farmers, largely Dutch, but increasingly German and other Europeans. French Huguenots went out in 1688. So the Boers are a hybrid group of people who originally spoke Dutch, but then from the late 19th century, as part of the rise of Afrikaner nationalism, very much in opposition to the British, began to develop their own language and codify their own language of Afrikaans. Yeah. So Boer means farmer, Afrikaans was their language, and the two Boer Wars were absolutely critical events in spurring modern Afrikaner nationalism. So during the 19th century, South Africa was divided in many different ways. There were African polities, Zulu, Tswana, Xhosa, and so forth, who had not yet been entirely conquered, either by the British, whose presence really grows through the 19th century, or by the Boers. The Boers begin to think of themselves as Afrikaners, as people from Africa, as indigenous people, particularly from the mid to late 19th century.
Great. Now, you mentioned on a couple of occasions that Winston Churchill was there at the time. He reported on the conflict. He famously escaped from prison. I mean, how does his involvement in the Boer War and the fact he was there and famously reported on it impact on his celebrity back in Britain?
Well, Churchill escapes from Boer incarceration. He describes his escape in rather florid ways. He swam across the mighty Arpies River, which is in fact just a stream. He comes back to Britain, and in the Kharki election, that is to say the Boer War election of 1900, he first enters Parliament. So it's a very important moment for him, shifting from being a war correspondent to entering politics. Churchill maintains strong connections with people who were around him during the Boer War. Leo Amery, for example, the Times correspondent and later an important British imperialist and colonial secretary, was at school with Churchill. They knew each other from that time. The other figure who is important to Churchill is Jan Smuts. Jan Smuts was one of the leading Boer War generals who went on to take an important role in the guerrilla war in the Cape, raiding behind British lines. And after the Union of South Africa is created in 1910, that is when Britain allows the emergence of a modern South Africa and turns, in a sense, a victory into defeat, but a kind of victory in another way, Smuts and Botha becomes the first prime minister, Smuts becomes his deputy, and Smuts then goes on to become one of the key figures in the development of the modern Commonwealth after his speech in speeches in London in 1917. He joins the Imperial War Cabinet. And in the Second World War, becomes very close and very important to Churchill. So in many ways, I think one can say that one of Churchill's formative experiences, and probably one that he would want to remember rather than his performance in the First World War, comes out of that engagement, involvement, the derring do, the excitement of the Boer War.
Now, your icon on Twitter asked the following question. How did the former enemies become reconciled after the Boer War, and how long did that process take? Now, I guess we could extend this question to ask, what were the chief legacies of the conflict in Southern Africa, and what were the long-term consequences of the war for the country of South Africa?
Well, that's an excellent question. The Boer War was an extremely bitter war. It was a civil war. It was a war that divided Afrikaners, because there were some who, known as the Hensoppers, the Hands-Uppers, who did not want to go into the guerrilla war indefinitely. It divided the British, and it divided English speakers in South Africa as well. There were many English speakers in the Cape in particular who were constitutionalists, who resented the imperial factor. In 1902, the country is devastated. The mines have come to a stop. The British find themselves in control of a country which isn't a nation state. And the only way forward is to have conciliation, reconciliation through the process of reconstruction between leading Boer figures like Jan Smuts and Louis Botha on the one hand, and the British, who after Milner is recalled to Britain, his kindergarten, his young Oxbridge-educated men who are the administrators, begin to work towards the idea of some kind of political settlement. And that comes to pass in 1909-1910, when the Union of South Africa is created as a self-governing independent state. Now, that reconciliation process was significantly aided by the recognition by all whites that they could only form a political settlement, or that the best way to create a political settlement was to unite on the basis of their race against the majority black population.
Right.
And so the real losers, if we might say, of the Boer War is indeed South African blacks. And it's in that period of reconstruction from 1902 to 1910 that the basic elements of racial segregation, that is a systematic political and economic reconstruction of the country in order to ensure that blacks lose their existing civil rights and that they become laborers on the gold mines and on farms and so forth, is created. So the process of reconciliation is a process of achieving white unity at the expense of black rights. And for that reason, the consequences and the legacy of the Boer War is extremely important. Now, there are other legacies, and that is that even though this process of reconciliation is substantially achieved, and surprising many people at the time, there were many Boers, the bitter enders and so forth, for whom the Boer War, the humiliations of the Boer War, the memories of the Boer War could never be reconciled. And it's in just at the time, 1912, the African National Congress is formed. In 1914, the Herzog, General Herzog, also a general in the Boer War, splits away from the ruling party and creates the National Party. And increasingly, modern Afrikaner nationalism, which finally triumphs in 1948 with the apartheid election, the memory of the Boer War, the humiliation, the injustice, and the depredations of imperialism, this figures extremely strongly in the mobilization of modern Afrikaner nationalism.
Thank you, Soren. And finally, I'd just like to ask, to what extent did the reverses that Britain suffered during the Boer War puncture the country's confidence in the imperial project and in the capability of its armed forces?
Another good question. The Boer War was an enormous war. It was probably the largest conflict the British were involved in since Crimea. It's the last of the great Victorian wars.
Yeah.
In military terms, it involves a very considerable amount of introspection led by people like Leo Amery, who writes the Times History of the War about the failures of the British, the failures to prevail. And they fix on certain aspects. There are military questions, organization, supply, how to fight a war, which is not just about set-piece battles, a total war. There are questions about arising out of the concentration camps, about modern nursing in field camps. There is also an interdepartmental commission of inquiry, which is set up just after the war in Britain and reports in 1904, called the Physical Deterioration Committee. And they are very much taken by the fact that the Boers outfight the British, and that many of the recruits, the British recruits, coming from cities like London, are ill-nourished. There is a great fear that of eugenic deterioration in the British working classes. So the Boer War also has an important impact on the ideology at the time of social efficiency, levelling up in today's parlance, if you like,
yeah.
Has quite a lot to do with the rise of social welfareism, pensions. All of these are some of the social consequences which are not directly attributable to the Boer War, but the Boer War creates is a moment of national introspection about the nature of British society. And so it does have important legacies, and it feeds as well into the lessons that the army draws going into the First World War.
That was Saul Dubow, Smuts Professor of Commonwealth History at the University of Cambridge, and the author of numerous works on South African history. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt, Jack Bateman, and Brittany Colley.